We are likely to trigger ourselves when we start poking around inside of our vagina.
Just knowing that brings a sense of, okay, that could happen. And I'm not crazy. I've just lost a baby in this very traumatic way through this area that I'm trying to now use. So it may feel confusing. Our TFMR stories, pregnancy loss support in the heartbreak of terminating a wanted pregnancy. Welcome back to another episode of our TFMR stories. I have a guest here for you today. It is my good friend and mentor in the grief field, Kate Carson. She is a grief support group extraordinaire, facilitator extraordinaire, and she has also turned her story and turned her passion into coaching people through this process with sex and relationships. So sex and relationship coaching and a lot going around with baby loss. So we're going to bring her on today and she's going to share 5 impediments to intimacy and everything that goes along with, you know, what we go through and TFMR, termination for medical reasons in the body and how that can feel afterwards. But she's going to give us some great advice. So welcome, Kate.
Thank you so much, Sabrina. It's good to be here.
So if you'd like to share a little bit about your story.
Absolutely. So my loss happened a long time ago now. I lost my baby in 2012. During that pregnancy, all of my doctors told me that she was okay. And I was sort of treated like an anxiety case because I didn't feel like she was okay. And it wasn't until about 35 weeks of pregnancy that I got sent in for a check it out scan. It was supposed to set my mind at ease, but instead they discovered that my baby had brain anomalies. And these brain anomalies were significant, but being 35 weeks pregnant, I was not able to access care at home. I lived in Boston, and this was when Roe v. Wade was still intact, but I was not protected because I was too far advanced into my pregnancy. So I was sent to Colorado, the Boulder Abortion Clinic, where I lost my baby. And my care there was excellent, but having to travel was really awful. It was really awful, and it compounded my loss a lot. And so I nod to all of the women who I'm sure in your group are having to travel now, because it's many people. It used to be rare, and now it's common. I came home, you know, empty womb, empty arms, and my baby was sent home to me as a pocket full of ashes in the mail eventually. And as you know, I mean, it's just devastating. My pregnancy was, you know, it was almost a full-term pregnancy. And so the process of giving my baby up was a birth process. I consider all of our processes birth processes because we're pregnant and then we're not. We have a baby in us and we deliver that baby through our cervix, through our vagina, or in rare cases, through C-section, through the womb wall, right? These are birth stories. And because of that, there's all of the waves. So my milk came in, the hormonal crash, the physical recovery, right? All of this. I was fortunate to have a living child. I had to weather this with while also caring for her, which is, it was a blessing. Ultimately, it's a blessing in every way. And also it's hard. It's hard to do even the most basic things when you're grieving, as you know. So at that time, I really was not able to work and was lucky enough not to have to work very hard that year. I then went back to being a classroom teacher of math and science because I had just graduated with a degree in engineering. I had planned to be a chemical engineer, but then I lost my baby literally like a week after my graduation. I got this diagnosis. So I ended up never going back to be an engineer. So instead, I went into the classroom. Where I had been a teacher for years before. And it was from there that I ended up transitioning to love, sex, and relationship coaching. Now, I've been holding space at ending a wanted pregnancy for the whole time, basically. I mean, I came in as a...
And thank you. Thank you for that. Thank you. Yes. That is how we met.
It is. And you're very welcome. You know, I came in seeking support myself. And as you and I have, we share this passion where you seek support, you get support, and it starts to transition into giving support and that fills us up. It really continues the healing for a long, long time, continues my healing to this day. So I knew that my passion was supporting moms and dads who have been through this loss. And my job was not that. Some of my activism and volunteer work was. But when COVID hit and teaching got like really different all of a sudden, Zoom school, I hated it. I saw it through the end of the year and I was like, that's it. I'm not doing this anymore. And I took the time to go to online. I mean, I guess that was Zoom school too when I got certified as a coach, but I went to online school.
but a little different, right?
It was like ground up designed to be on the computer, whereas we were all like rapidly trying to our curricula. So I studied with Layla Martin, who's a love, sex, and relationship coach and teacher herself. And I got this beautiful certification because in all those years of baby loss space holding, I noticed that one of the biggest pain points is how it affects relationships. Now, the relationship to your spouse, the relationship to your own body, right? These are all relationships. And that and the relationship to your sexuality as well. And that those needs were really not being addressed competently by the mental support community at large, right? I mean, I would hear a lot, well, I have a psychologist, but I don't feel comfortable talking to her about sex. Or I talk to my gynecologist, but like, I don't feel like she just gave me some hormones, right? So everyone's trying to help. Everyone wants to help. But I noticed that like this little nexus was a place that was not addressed in a grief-informed way. That's why I pursued being a love, sex, and relationship coach, because I really wanted to serve this group in particular.
TFMR. Yeah, it's like a niche within a niche within a niche.
It is.
and it's needed because at the same time that it's like this higher hierarchical need, right? Like sexuality and sex, it's also a base need.
Yeah. I really feel that sexuality is one of the most basic needs. Like, okay, food is a more basic need because without sex, you will not die, but without food, you will die, right? So air, clean water, food, shelter are the more basic needs. But right after that comes sex. It's a biological need. You get hungry when you need food. If you're healthy, your body should get arousal when you want to be close and when you want to form that intimate bond with someone. A lot of us may not be feeling that after TFMR, and that's, we'll talk about it, but when you have something so visceral in your body, it's an important part of human life, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's so connected to TFMR. I mean, even if we had to go the IVF route, there's still, the sex and the sex cells.
Oh gosh. Especially if you have to go to the IVF route, because if you have to go the IVF route, God knows how many months you've been charting and like, we gotta go now, it's time, right?
Oh, there's already so much body trauma just from fertility treatments.
Oh, and yeah, absolutely. So much pain on the body. I mean, the physical toll that IVF takes on the body, the emotional toll because of the way they switch your hormones around, right? Mm-hmm. It's enormous. It's enormous. And I would definitely say that if you have experienced IVF, even in the absence of a loss, you might benefit from my work, right? Mm-hmm. And from sexuality work in particular. But in the addition to a loss, it's just a lot. Your body and your soul have been through a lot.
Yeah, it's so much. And when you were telling your story, I was really drawn to the piece of having to travel for care and how that is, like you said, a much more common experience now, at least in the US. Probably may happen in other places too, or was already happening in some countries. People have to go to another country. And that's related to the body. It's like visceral.
Yes.
You have to take your body. Like I had to take my body and get on a bus. Like that bus ride was like the shame ride.
Yes. I remember, I mean, we had to take a flight. I live in Boston, Colorado. It's 2,000 miles away, right? So I had to go to Logan and get in line and like hold my ticket and check my luggage. And I had to do this all 8 months pregnant when you know those airlines don't want an 8-month pregnant lady on the plane, right? If they had known that, they would not have let me on. And so I dressed myself in my husband's clothes. He's a bigger person than I am. And I dressed myself in these like big sort of formless things just to try to like eat me up, right? Just to try to mask my body out of necessity. But it adds to the shame when you have to hide that you're even pregnant. And when we got to Colorado, my procedure is 4 days long. I had to be there for 5 days, for a week. We had a hotel. I did not want to walk in and out the front door. I sat my body on the curb by the emergency exit, and my husband would let me in the side door. That was not his, that was me. I was the one who did not want to walk in pregnant and out pregnant one morning and in not pregnant in the afternoon, right? So and it compounds the shame, which compounds the trauma. It's horrible. It's horrible to have to travel. It's a human rights violation, and it just compounds. It's hard enough to lose your baby, but to feel like your whole political, social culture is against you in it is just rotten. It's just rotten.
Yeah. So we're not, you know, jumping back in the bed with our partner 3 days often after that.
Often not. And for, you know, for me too, this is the first impediment to intimacy. Can I dive right in? Because it fits.
Go ahead. Okay. So let's do the five.
So the first impediment to intimacy is your physical recovery. You've had a birth. You were pregnant for a certain amount of time, and then you had a procedure of some type, and now you're not pregnant anymore. There is a physical recovery that has to happen, and that is the first impediment to intimacy after this loss. So yes, in my case, I had an almost full-term pregnancy that I delivered a baby in a clinic in Colorado. I had a vaginal birth. Fortunately for me, there were no complications, as is, I want to make sure that, well, everyone here has been through a procedure, but chances are there are no complications. But if you are unlucky enough twice and you have both the tragedy and the complication, well, that makes your need for physical recovery even longer, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's even longer, or retained products and then having to have
retained products that lead to pelvic inflammation and infection like that. It can drag on. If you are very unlucky and have to have a complication to this loss, the loss being more than enough to suffer in the first place. Yes. But even for those of us like me, for whom it goes perfectly, there's still a physical recovery. There's a need for rest. And by rest, I mean both physical rest, like sleeping, and pelvic rest, like no tampons and no penises and no fingers and no dildos in your vagina, right? Like nothing in the vagina for pelvic rest. Now, the amount of time that that makes sense is going to vary from woman to woman, and I don't want to put a time limit on it. I want you to talk to your own medical team about the right amount of time for pelvic rest from a health of the uterus perspective, health of the vagina, right?
Yeah. But there's the emotions that go along needing to do the physical rest because we've had so much ripped from us. Our babies have just died. And then we're having full on postpartum recovery in our body with no baby. It's like, that was supposed to be the prize. That was supposed to be like, what was going to make this worth it? And they're not here.
No. And in many cases, as my own, the body produces milk, right?
Yeah.
It seems I'm hearing more doctors prescribing medication to drive the milk. So know that you can ask your doctor about that. When I went through it, really, it was sort of unheard of. Like they really didn't do it. And I don't really know why. I think
why, I'm glad it's happening.
I suspect it traces back to, you know, the big push for breastfeeding that people, they stopped prescribing it to mothers of living children in an effort not to have as many formula fed babies, which to women in our shoes is like, why do you care when we're talking about living and dying? Right. But I think
the push for breast is best. But in our case, there's no baby. So
there's no baby. There's no baby. And nobody should ever be pressured into donating milk. It's beautiful if it's your thing, but for me, it would have been a real cruelty. So the physical recovery and need for rest is one of our impediments to intimacy, and it's not one I want you to try to overcome. It's one I want you to completely honor, okay? Most women tend towards wanting to rest. Some women tend towards wanting intimacy. And if that's you, know that intimacy is more than something in your vagina, right? Intimacy can be cuddles. Intimacy can be making out. Intimacy can be erotic massage on the outside of your body or on the outside of your partner's body, right? Or on the inside of your partner's body, right? These are things that are still totally fair game. So if you want that physical intimacy, just honor the pelvic rest and really let yourself explore, even for someone who doesn't want a lot of physical intimacy, what is it like to hold hands? What is it like to reach out and touch your partner? This counts. Little things count. So honor the body's need for rest. Sleep as much as you can. Just take all pressure off. There's no race to get back.
Oh, thanks for saying that, Kate. You're bringing up memories of that time, termination, where my husband, sometimes we cuddle and then he like rolls away and then he goes to sleep, right? But that time after we lost our baby, he would cuddle me all night.
Yes. Yes.
And I think that was even more important than us having sex or not.
I think so.
That type of intimacy can be very important in this time.
And it, for those who are a love language of physical touch, that absolutely counts. It absolutely counts.
I think we both are.
So, yeah. That's beautiful. Mm-hmm. The second impediment to intimacy after TFMR is when you start to associate your sexual organs as reproductive organs only. So it's like this co-opting of sexuality into reproduction. And particularly when there's been reproductive trauma, which I think I can pretty safely say we have all experienced, right?
Yeah, I would say so,
unfortunately. So there's this trauma layer, right? And there's this like redefinition of what your vagina, what your vulva is for. And ultimately, we're going to need a reclamation here to overcome this. However, before you can do that, the way I recommend working with this is to really honor your no first. So especially where there's been medical trauma, where sometimes they're doing things to you that you can't really say no to, right? The procedure in and of itself, I signed my consent.
Right.
And also, I did not like or welcome it, right?
Oh, yeah. I like to say, you know, I consented, but I was not consenting.
Right.
I want any of those things to be happening to my body.
Right.
It's a lot of what I processed in EMDR trauma therapy.
Totally. And this, if you're experiencing this and it's getting in the way of your intimacy, pursuing trauma therapy, EMDR is totally a great idea. You don't have to work on sexuality with your EMDR therapist if you don't want to. Just working on the trauma point will help. So I think the place to start is with the word no, right? There were many no's you wanted to say that you couldn't say in this experience. And maybe in your reproductive life before this experience, there were no's you wanted to say and didn't say.
Comes up.
Yep. So I heard this beautiful quote that you cannot say one true yes until you have said every single no that you've never said. So where I would start with this is just setting aside time to be like, no to this and no to that and no to that. And you can go back in your memory. You can sort of work as though you said no here and there, right? And you can just lie and you can kick and you can beat up the pillows. You can make a real full-bodied no. I recommend starting just by yourself, but there's room to bring your partner into no exercises as well. There's a beautiful exercise where you sit in the back corner of a room and your partner stands in the doorway. And every time you say yes, your partner takes a step towards you. And every time you say no, he takes a step back. And you can no him out the house and down the street if you want to. And you both consent to play this game, You know it's a game. You know it's okay. It's not about your partner. It's about your body really learning that your partner is committed to your no. Your partner can even cheer for you and be like, I love it when you know me for this exercise. And even though it seems like such a silly thing, it starts to make the body feel safe. Like, this is different. My partner is different. The other side of this is the yes. Once you start to feel like you've said every no you need to say, look for the yeses. What are you a yes to? What do you want to eat right now? Right?
Yeah. Yeah. Tiny pleasures.
Yeah. Tiny pleasures. And you start cultivating your yeses and feeding your body all of the yeses and then really letting them land in your body. So when something is pleasurable.
Really hard, Kate. I remember that being really, really hard for like at least 6 months or a year.
Yeah. 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 And we'll talk about why it's hard, right? But the littlest thing you can really accept, feed it to yourself. Feed it to yourself. Also, please be on really good birth control during this time, because your body's not going to want to consent to sex that it sees as a threat. Now, you may not want to be on birth control because you may want to be having a baby and getting pregnant again. And, you know, I understand that, and you may not have time, but if you have the luxury of time, give yourself some time where your body knows that the risk is really not there, that this is not for having a baby, that this is for pleasure. And then there are a few nervous system hacks that you can use. So any touch that soothes your body, just start there. It doesn't have to be foreplay. It can be the whole thing. A back massage, no strings attached, is what most of my clients want the most in their marriage, right? Great. You can do a little bit. I have this makeup brush right here. Your vagus nerve comes close to the skin on your neck. Touch your vagus nerve, both sides of the neck, and then it goes down into the chest. I have a vibrator. It's not a sexual vibrator. It's like a massager. And I put it on my chest and goes bzzz. And then on your gut, you can gut massage yourself. These are body hacks. These are ways to tell your body it's safe. The danger is not here right now. We can relax. So just start practicing.
Because the trauma does that to us. It's like, danger, danger. It's still here. Yeah. Here's your flashback so you can relive it.
Exactly.
Like it's happening right now again.
Totally. Totally. Absolutely. And we're likely to, I mean, this is the real meaning of trigger. Yes. We are likely to trigger ourselves when we start poking around inside of our vagina.
Yeah. There's just a lot. Just knowing that brings a sense of, okay.
Yeah.
That could happen. And I'm not crazy. I've just lost a baby in this very traumatic way through this area that I'm trying to now use.
Yeah.
So it may feel confusing.
Totally. Totally. So much patience, so much love. And we're still honoring the no's. So if you start to be intimate and all of a sudden you get a no, you're going to say no and your partner is going to back off. And you're going to sit and think, what would I be a yes to right now? And you're going to go in that direction instead.
And we can express that. You know? So if there's something that's a no, oh, you know, I'd really love maybe that, my neck.
Yeah. Yeah. A little bit of neck touch.
Yeah.
I'd really love it if you just tell me all the things you love about me right now. I really could use that right now. Something like that.
Yeah. And our partners, they want to show up, but sometimes they're just as confused. They're grieving too. They don't know how to make it better. And there's nothing that you can do to make it better.
No.
It's sitting amongst the devastation.
Yeah. There really is no fixing this. There really is no fixing it. And that can be a big pill to swallow when you're at the outset and it hurts so much. When I say there's no fixing it, though, I don't mean it will always hurt that way forever, because it doesn't hurt that same exact way forever.
Yeah.
This episode is sponsored by two separate programs that were created just for parents like you who have had to end a wanted pregnancy for health reasons. The first program I want to share with you is our upcoming in-person TFMR retreat, which will be held in beautiful central Mexico on April 4th through the 7th of this year, 2024. Kate, who you hear speaking in this episode, and I are the facilitators. So if you like what we're talking about and you want to experience this live, come on retreat with us for holistic healing together in TFMR community. More info at thetfmrdoula.com/tfmr-retreat. The second program I'd like to invite you to check out is our TFMR Grief Circle program, which I call Ascend. We enroll quarterly, so check out the upcoming dates at thetfmrdoula.com, and that's ascend-apply to look into this program. This transformative 3-month program is a safe, virtual, small group setting of 4 or 5 other bereaved parents like you. All links will be in the description. These programs are for you to help you find and feel the care of other TFMR parents who have your back and see you in your grief.
So why is it so hard to accept the simple pleasures? Because reason number 3, block to intimacy, The patterns of guilt that we develop, the patterns of unworthiness, self-punishment, self-deprivation. So this gets into the real emotional shadows of this experience, right? The guilt, the regret, the just like the heaviness of the responsibility and not knowing what to make of it on a big, epic right and wrong field, right? I remember I would like sort of compulsively be like, I saved my baby. I killed my baby. I saved my baby. I killed my baby. And I'm not using those words for anyone. These are my words for me, right? I'm not putting them on anyone else. But it took a lot for me to melt and be like, oh, I'm not going to try to make these make sense. I'm just going to let all the feelings be in me at once. It's okay. It's okay. So if you are depriving yourself of pleasure because you feel like you shouldn't have it, or you feel like if you feel pleasure, it means you moved on and you worry that it's making you lose your baby even more, we need to build worthiness. So how do we build the worthiness?
That's a big one.
Yeah. I think the most effective path to that, this is going to seem a little to the side, but I think the most effective path to building worthiness and receiving pleasure is to say, okay, I know I have my feelings, and each feeling is telling me a story. And some of the stories are, you are bad and wrong and don't deserve to feel good. And some of the stories are, if you feel good, it means you forgot your baby. Mm-hmm, I'm just going to like put in my earplugs and sit with the feeling. So it's sort of like, if you've ever had like a crazy loved one whom you adore, but you know they don't always tell the truth, you're still happy to see them. You'll still sit with them. Or if you have ever been a caretaker of children and children have their own filters of reality, which aren't quite real, right? You're not going to be like, no, you're wrong. Get out of here. Nor are you going to believe them. You're just going to be like, honey, I love you. And that's it. I'm glad you're here. I'm glad we're here together. Right? This is how to treat the feelings. Now, it's basically taking the emotion and its story and separating them. And they're one of the ways I find the easiest to do this is to do what we call parts work, which is to let yourself be more than one person at once. Now, trauma tends to fracture the self, I mean, like the ego, like the perception of the self, into a lot of different clear separate pieces. So it may be very easy and natural for you to do this. For me, one of the like meanest parts in me that was sort of torturing me the most, it was just like relentless and really made me feel guilty and really just kept my energy sapped all of the time. Finally, one day I had just like had enough and I sort of gave up and I was like, I'm going to turn towards you instead of fighting you today part. And when I turned towards this part and I got to know her, I call her my guard dog. She's just trying to protect me, but she's sort of a bitch.
Definitely.
Her motivation is to protect me. She loves me. Yeah. She's just doing what she knows how to do. Just like a big, angry, mad guard dog is going to do what it knows how to do to protect its person. She's just trying to protect me. And when I could sort of see that and be like, oh, okay, I get it. Also, I don't need this right now. What are you protecting me from, right? Then I could feel the feeling. So you can do this. You can personify your feelings. You can interact with them this way. You can say, thank you. And will you please let me see what you're hiding? That for me really opened up a lot of sadness.
Yeah. Well, and I know you do somatic work with your clients, and you can like lead them to this place gently, you know, appropriately, and help them work through it.
I do.
So that's something that if you're feeling like you need to do this along with someone, Kate can do that for you.
Yes. I love doing this kind of work with people. I love helping them find the parts of themselves. If it feels too scary to befriend a part that feels too mean or too bad or too wrong, or like you're afraid if you befriend that part, it will mean that you were wrong and like you'll have to let go of the part that knows you did a merciful thing, right? It can help to have a guide in this. And I do that. I do guide.
Yeah. I have a meditation track as well. I have some mindfulness program for TFMR parents.
Gorgeous.
It's called Peace of Mind. And one of the tracks is befriending your tough emotions.
I love that.
It's guided.
Yeah.
But yeah, getting that guide somehow can be helpful.
It can really be helpful. There's another part of the self I call the crisis self. And this also fits into the unworthiness. Sometimes we can't understand the decision we made. Or when it's over, we can understand the decision, the big decision we made, but we can't understand the smaller decisions we made, like about whether or not to view your baby, whether or not to cremate your baby, whether or not to ask about cremation, right? These are what I call the small regrets. They are not small in sensation. They are small in like compared to life or death decisions about your child. These are really not as big, but you feel the full weight of the sensation of regret.
They feel so big. It feels like an enormous regret, but I like that you calling it a small regret.
Yeah, because it's a small place to land, right? In comparison to baby, nothing could compare, right? But when we lose our baby, there's a lot of real regret around that that does not have to mean you regret your choice.
Yeah.
The regret is like the weight of your responsibility with the permanence of the answer and just the pain of the answer, right? All of that is regret. And then it all lands over here on like, I wish I had held my baby's body. Or over here on like, I wish I had had a different procedure, right? Like,
Yeah. So was that yours, Kate?
That mine was.
Held her?
So I viewed her, and in the moment, what was very true to me was, this is not my baby. This is just her body. I don't need to hold her. So I didn't pick her up and hold her to my chest. Yeah. Oh boy, did I wish I had later. In the moment, it was clear. Why would I do that? She's not here. But later, how much anguish did I feel that I never knew what it was like to have her in my arms, that I could have and I just didn't, right?
Could I share mine?
Please, yeah.
So mine was what you mentioned, the not getting her cremated. Because the doctor at the clinic said, oh, we don't usually get that request. And yeah, I guess we could kind of help you all out, but it would be a lot of paperwork and it would be, you know, it was like him trying to save more emotional turmoil.
Yeah.
But the emotional turmoil came back tenfold later when I realized, well, I'll never have her ashes. Yes. I didn't get her ashes because I was convinced and I agreed. In that moment, I was in my crisis self.
Yes.
And I said, yeah, I don't want to put myself through that. The paperwork, I can barely write my name right now. Sure. Okay. I don't want to, I can't do that to myself right now.
Yes. Yes. And my crisis self knew, oh, it's already over. It's already over. This is, you've done everything you can do for her. It's done. Oh. Right. So the crisis self is the part that got us through the crisis. If we had to show up every day like to these we would just curl up into a ball and die. Like, there's no way we would have survived this. It's too horrible. It's too horrible. So crisis self had to come and save our butts and save our babies, right? And then crisis self disappears when the crisis is over and we're left like, why did I do that? Why didn't I do that? What was I thinking?
Yeah. I think I've seen you write that crisis self does not care about nostalgia and rituals and little connections.
No, crisis self only cares about life and death. Once the life and death is like worked out, she's gone, right? But she does not care about, she's not sentimental at all.
Not
but
sentimental, then, yeah.
Yeah, grieving mothers, we are sentimental.
It's all we have left. It's all we have left, those little memories or their little urn or...
I know. And I have so much love for all of these parts. I really do like love my crisis self for saving my family. And first of all, Laurel, first of all, my baby and also me. Right. But I also love my guard dog, like my big bitchy guard dog who was just making me miserable for so long. Like, I think she's great. Now that I know where I can set her and she's like so happy to serve me and I'm so happy to not have to be tender every moment of every day of my life, you know, great. So this is when I talk about the pattern of guilt and unworthiness and the self-punishment. Really, what I want you to do with that is to learn to feel somatically and learn your pantheon of inner parts, right? And just deal with them one piece at a time. So the somatic feeling of like, oh, I'm so sad is, it might be like, I feel tears in my eyes. I feel a lump in my throat. I feel heavy. I feel cold. I feel like languid, right? The feeling of I'm so angry might be I'm hot. I feel like I'm going to explode. I feel like I want to scream. Then go scream if you can. That's even better for embodiment, right? So we just embody the feeling and whatever story it's telling, you just yes, honey it, right? And like, don't worry about listening to it, but you invite the feeling into the fold and you feel it in your body. And the more willing you are to feel the feelings in your body, oh, it starts to feel less like you're a broken, terrible person and more like, oh, I'm just a person. Like, I'm just an animal on this earth. I'm a grieving mother. It's okay. Like, these are all okay to feel.
Yeah. And I think it's helped me to think of those as thoughts. Like, I'm having a thought that I made the wrong decision when I didn't get her ashes, or I'm having a thought that this means that I'm a so-and-so mother.
Yes.
And then you just let it be a thought form.
Yeah. I like, what am I making this mean? What am I making it mean that I didn't pick her up?
Because
it doesn't inherently mean I love her any less. Oh, that's interesting.
The hurt underneath the hurt.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Beautiful.
And I'm feeling like it's important for us to do this work because we're getting intimate with ourselves.
Yes.
We're getting intimate with our body and our thoughts and our emotions.
Yes.
And when we can do that, then it can be easier to be intimate with another person.
Totally. Totally. And when we talk about physical sensations in the body as one way to experience emotions, an exercise for this impediment might be just like, stroke your own skin and feel it. Like, really, presence in the body, bringing it back to presence in the body. It may sound really far away when I'm talking about like all these parts, like this pantheon of characters.
Yeah.
But each one will have, when you meet them, you'll find they leave an impression on your body. Like, each one has a sensation in the body. So it's not actually separate work. Mm. And just, okay, keep it safe. Keep it in an area that's okay, that feels safe. And just, what does this feel like? What does it feel like if I use a feather? What does it feel like if I use my brush? What does it feel like if I use an ice cube, right? Just different sensations in the body and practicing staying in the body for touch. You know, even at the best of times, even people who are completely uninitiated into loss and pregnancy tend to get disembodied during sex. And even just staying with touch can revolutionize a normal person's sex life. It will also build that for us as well. But baby steps. You'll notice that when I talk about overcoming these impediments, I have yet to recommend that you like jump in the sack and just have sex. No, baby steps.
No, we're getting there, but little by little.
My fourth impediment is anger with your partner. And this is someone that you may or may not relate to, but I know that the way my anger at my partner manifests is that I get angry that he doesn't know what it's like to have had to go through that physically. I like wish, I feel it's so unfair that we couldn't actually share it. Like we do, but we don't, right? There are aspects of it I wish I could have shared with him. And I also would feel angry at him at times because there is a real emotional disconnect, many, many, many instances after in grief, right? And we think, well, we're supposed to be in it together. We had the same loss.
This is our baby.
Yes, but it doesn't feel like that, does it? No. The thing I most needed to do was talk about it. And the thing he could least do, he most needed not to talk about it or to hear about it. So our needs were diametrically opposed. And sometimes I would get really pissed off at him. Don't you even care? Don't you even remember her? Of course he remembers her. Those are really not fair things for me to say, but that's the way it felt. And the anger would just come out, right? And, you know, that's an impediment to intimacy. Judgment, anger, projection. Because in my case, I was judging his grief mostly because I was like, why am I so dysfunctional? How can you go to work when I'm crumpled in a crying heap on the floor? Why am I crumpled in a heap on the floor when he can go to work? What's wrong with me, right? This projection.
How can you do that to me?
Yeah. How can you leave me here alone?
And yet they're not doing anything to us.
No.
But it feels that way.
Yeah. I mean, literally.
Guard dog anger popping up again.
Totally. Right. So if you're angry at your partner, there's a bit of assessment that needs to take place, because in some of these partnerships of your listeners, it really will be shitty and the partner really will be misbehaving and really will be doing things that aren't fair, right? But in many, they're like mine, where the relationship was actually quite healthy. We just had different needs and very different grief styles. So you're going to have to do a bit of discernment. Like, is this a real no to something that is truly wrong? Or is this my guard dog trying to protect me from feeling inadequate? So you sit with it and you feel for it. And whatever truth comes up, you can trust. So once you've discerned, once you've done your discernment, and like, is this real anger that's like a no that needs to be said and talked about? Or is this like perhaps anger that is a projection or is guard dog or part, or like maybe not what I want to act on today?
How do you figure that out?
Well, here's an exercise.
Some people go to therapy in grief too.
Yeah.
That could be a good place to work on that.
You could do it in therapy. I can help people with clarity around this, but here's an exercise I really like for helping. Away from your partner, away from all people, you set aside time to play angry music, do an angry dance, beat up some pillows. If you have a punching bag, now is your time to use it. You know, just like exhaust your body in the anger, feel it, really inhabit it, live anger at 100%. What is it like to let yourself be all the way angry? You can picture your partner's face on those pillows. It's fine. You can't hurt your partner by beating up these pillows, right? Express. And then after at least 2 minutes of full expression, you turn down the music or leave it up and you sit right in the silence and in the center of the anger, and you feel it swirling and swirling and swirling around you like a hurricane, and you're right in the eye of the storm. So you sit very still and you just let it move around and through you. And once it's expressed, and once you've found the still point in it, you just ask for the truth to blossom up, for like what is true to bubble up to the surface. I think you'll find something. I trust your body to deliver it.
Yeah. And if we can go through making a huge decision about TFMR, caring to term, whatever decision, you know,
yeah,
we can do a practice like this and find that in us.
Yeah. And once you have your clarity, you can also ask in this still point, what do I really want from my partner? Like, what would perfect showing up look like?
That's a powerful question.
When you know what that looks like, if your answer is, well, it would look like not doing that, turn it around. What's the opposite of that? It would look like setting aside 15 minutes every night to hold me and let me talk and cry without taking it personally. We could set a timer, and at the end of it, we would each say, I love you. And then that would be the vent of the day, right? Something like that. Put limits on it. How much is enough? What are the parameters? How do you want your partner to act? When you know how you want your partner to show up, you can start to ask. Now, your partner is also an autonomous human. Maybe your partner has a backlog of no's a mile long, and maybe your partner says no. When you make a true ask, no is an acceptable answer. And if you get a no, you say thank you, and you work on your next ask. And you say thank you to every no, so that your partner, this is like your partner stepping back into the street as you say no. Every time you can genuinely thank your partner for your no, it becomes safer for your partner to say yes.
Oh, yeah.
It's hard
because we want what we want, and we want it now. And especially in this huge grief and upheaval and all of the anxiety and anger that comes along with grief, it can be like, oh, I've already been through so much. Just give me this. But they may not be able to, just like we may not be able to show up how we did before grief.
Yeah.
We're going through a lot.
I mean, I'm not the same person I was before.
No.
And I'm sure you're not either.
No.
And I've come to really love who I am now more than before. But Jesus, it was a long road. It's a long road to get here.
It's quite long.
It's longer than we want it to have to be. In the grand scheme of a lifetime, it's not that long. But in the moment, it's excruciatingly long.
Yeah. And it feels never ending.
Yeah. So when we ask our partner for what we need, if you're trying to rekindle intimacy, there's an emotional intimacy just to asking. So in asking, you are rekindling emotional intimacy. Of course, you can ask for physical touch, but be specific. How do you want it? Where do you want it? How many minutes of this do you want, right? Be very specific. Make it contained. It's safer to do something when there's a timer on and you know the exactly where to touch and exactly how to touch. Baby steps, we're building the trust back into your body, into your physical body, into your partner's physical body, so that it starts to feel safe and good to be together.
Yeah, I remember feeling really angry at my husband, like it was all his fault.
Yeah.
Like, oh, it must have been his faulty sperm. I blamed it all on him or his poor health or his older age. And I was very angry at him.
I wanted it to be the first sperm's fault real bad too.
All right. You don't want it to be you. But then I eventually realized, you know, we don't even know.
We can't know. I mean, you and I can't know. Some people do know because they do the genetic.
Some people do. If you carry it. But but even like, let's even say he's a carrier and 1 in 4 of his sperm carries this whatever. He still didn't choose. He didn't like pick it out and put it, you know,
No, and it's not a silly thing to do to have children just because you carry some gene. Like, of course, the drive to have children is strong. Of course you want your own kids, right? This is very natural. It's not his fault. It's not my fault. It's not your fault. It's not my husband's fault.
No, there's no fault.
No.
And I think there's sadness underneath that.
Yeah.
Underneath the anger towards him. It's just like, I'm just really sad that this happened to the two of us.
Yeah. And sometimes there's fear, especially if you're fixating on what fault it is. You're just trying to figure out what you can fix for next time. How can we do better next time? How can we be better next time? Because the truest thing I can tell you is that everything that is living will die. Like, that's the only truth I can really give you about life, is that it's going to end.
Yeah.
And yet there are parts of us that really want to make it perfect. Well, we can't. I'm a biological product of nature, and so are you. It's way too much to control. That's scary. That's really scary when the stakes are as high as your beloved children.
Yeah.
The last impediment to intimacy is that after a pregnancy, your body is unfamiliar to you. A pregnancy and a birth leave you unfamiliar with your body and uncertain of your pleasure. So maybe you're not sure that you can access orgasm the same way you could before. Or maybe you're afraid it's going to hurt. Maybe it even does hurt. Right? So also unfamiliar body can also encompass, I'm worried about how I look now. That can, and there's judgment on the look of the body. So this one, I guess I would just say, we need a basic re-education about your body as it is now, right? I am a 41-year-old woman now. I became sexually active. I was a late bloomer. I was in my early 20s when I became sexually active. I am a lifetime further along than I was when I was 20, right? So why would I expect everything to be the same? Why would I expect to look the same, for everything that felt the same then to feel the same? I mean, there are some changes that happen to our bodies in pregnancy, which are actually, they enhance our pleasure. Not everything that happens to your body is an impediment to your pleasure. So there are new neural pathways that are built during pregnancy. There's a lot more vasculature that ends up in your pelvis. These things can build greater pleasure in your body. Some of the hormonal shifts I'm going through now, perimenopausal, can leave testosterone a little bit higher than it was before relative to estrogen and progesterone. That can lead to more turn on in the body, right? So don't look at it as like an expiring or a ruining. It's not that at all. It's just a new phase of life. We women cycle. We cycle every month for a huge portion of our life, but we also go through all the cycles of our moods and all the cycles of the year, of the seasons of the year, the cycles of a lifetime as well, right? Okay, we're leaving one season and going into the next. I am leaving summer and headed into autumn right now in my life. Well, autumn is a bountiful time. Why would I mourn my young, fit spring self when I'm coming into the bounty of this time in my life, right? So a little bit of basic re-education of your body can be that, can be like the archetypes of womanhood. It can also be you get a book like Women's Anatomy of Arousal and you learn your parts. Women's Anatomy of Arousal. I was a scientist and a science teacher. When I read that book, I was like, what? These are parts I've never heard about. It's things like, it shows you where all your erectile tissue is. We have as much erectile tissue as men. Ours is just inside of our pelvis. It talks about different orgasms and different pleasure, right? You can learn new orgasms at any stage of life. So education, tender communication with your partner. My body is different and I don't know it anymore. And sometimes that makes me afraid to be intimate. I have yet to meet a couple.
Vulnerable. Yeah.
Sorry?
Oh, I said, yeah, that's really vulnerable.
Oh, so vulnerable.
And a truth.
Yeah. But you know what I hear a lot of in the world at large, not just from, I'm not talking client pool now, I'm hearing the world at large. I hear a lot of, my husband just doesn't satisfy me anymore. So that's the projection of the vulnerability. If you're like, oh, you're just bad at sex, that's often it's too uncomfortable for me to share how much I don't know my body anymore and how scared I am that I won't have an orgasm again.
Yeah. Because a man hearing that would be like, oh, I'm going to take on that challenge. Whereas if you said, you know, you're not doing it for me anymore, it's like, okay, what can I do about that? Right. But if you share the vulnerable truth under there, it's like, oh, okay, well, there's a problem.
What I find with the couples I work with in particular is that when the woman can express that, she's expecting him to be disappointed in her and to feel like she's damaged goods. But instead he's like, oh, you mean we get to, like, everything gets to be fresh again? Like, we get to start from ground zero? We get to, like, figure things out from scratch? And he gets, like, really sweetly excited to discover the pleasure with her again. Also, it's really important to know, too, I mean, I'm talking sort of in a heteronormative way, so apologies.
Yeah, I was going to mention that, but
it applies to everyone. The person who has gone through the pregnancy is more likely to be the one who feels out of touch and insecure about the pleasure. Not necessarily, but more likely. Now,
yeah, not in my case, actually. It was it was my partner who tended to not. Yeah. And I think it was from some of these things, you know, like if we do this, are we going to like mess up another baby?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, sometimes I find that men are particularly conditioned that to be like, they, first of all, they have to please their woman. They have to be good in bed. And in order to do that, the standard is sort of robotic.
Hmm.
Like you have to get aroused and get an erection immediately. It has to be rock hard. Oh. It has to like be this ridiculous size. And then you have to be able to maintain that while pumping for like ever. And it just is not very realistic. It's more mechanical, the expectation. Sometimes, particularly when there's been a long fertility journey, the man feels like it's too much pressure to ejaculate on. It's not very sexy at all. It's very much.
Yeah.
And so for men too, I think you're right that co-opting of sex for reproduction is not great.
Not good for intimacy. Not good for sex is pleasure. Not good for, this is something that we want to do together for us, but for the two of us. Yes. Or if there's another partner, you know, for us. Yes,
if you're polyamorous.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So I would just say to take a real beginner's mind and invite your partner into beginner's mind with you here too. You get to start over and see it as, well, we're going to discover new pleasure in each other. So even if only one person has gone through this process, both people get to start from square one because time has passed. And you're entitled to try and enjoy new things, right? So one of the practices that I do with couples who are interested in doing sexual practices with the help of a coach, they're tantric penis massage or tantric yoni massage. And so it's a massage of the genitals, and it's sort of prescribed. Like I talk about the strokes, though the person receiving can always adjust and can always ask for changes. But it's really about the attention. It's about the devotional attention of the one giving, and it's about the surrendered experiencing of the one receiving. There's no orgasm that has to happen in this practice. It's just about feeling what's, it's like a mindfulness practice involved with erotic stimulation, right? With erotic massage. And it's very beautiful, and it's very different than most people have experienced for a long time since they were like just exploring from scratch. And even then they may have rushed things, and there's no rush here. That's a gift. That's not a handicap. That's a really beautiful, expansive thing to try together. And you're in it together, which is beautiful. Yeah.
I can see how this is a number five, though. It's like after we've gone through all of the other steps.
Yes. Yeah, it really is the number five because, you know, you can explore bodies even when you're in physical recovery if you keep it to places that aren't internal. But there's so much emotional stuff that might make this difficult. And it's okay if there is, and it's okay if it takes a long time to get here.
Yeah, I think that that's a really important point, that if you're in a difficult part of this journey, just know that like your sex life is not broken. You're not broken.
No.
You're just having to go through these different stages to get to a new place because it's going to be new.
Yes. It is going to be new. Another tool that can really help is self-pleasure practice, especially if you're not quite at the verbal communication level to like invite your partner in. Set aside time for self-pleasure. You know, many people will call it masturbation. I find that word is very heavy with judgment from a lot of particularly religious faiths. So I call it self-pleasure practice, but where you can give yourself erotic touch and just relearn your body, knowing, as we talked about before, that often emotions will come up when you do touch your genitals or your breasts after a baby loss. And let it be okay. Let it be okay. You never have to push past your, again, as with everything, if your body says no, you change plans. What am I a yes to instead? But it's very healthy to touch yourself, really.
I'm feeling very tender with this conversation. Maybe sadness or regret or... And also just remembering how hard, you know, like the first 6 months, the first year after I lost my baby was. And
Yes.
Trying to move through all of these things and needing to have EMDR therapy so I could have sex with my husband again. Like, that felt so unfair, you know?
It really is unfair. It really is just a lot. It's so much that we go through. And it makes so much sense that it sort of cascades into our sex life. It doesn't mean broken. You're not bad. You're not wrong. This makes so much sense. It makes all the sense in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that of course it's connected.
Yeah.
Of course it is. But since it's connected and since it's connected to love and emotions, we can work through it. We can find different ways. And you've given us lots of different examples and ideas and practices to try out. So thank you so much, Kate, for sharing your wisdom.
It was wonderful to talk to you, Sabrina. I always love to.
Anything you would like to add, or where can people find you?
My heart really goes out to all of your listeners, who I feel most are probably fresher in this than I am. And I remember what it was like, and it's terrible. And I just am, you know, holding, I'm sort of reaching out and holding us all in one big bubble in time and space, because it's just a lot. And where you can find me, if you want to, you can certainly find me at Ending a Wanted Pregnancy if you're interested in Facebook-based support. You go to the website, though, endingawantedpregnancy.com, to apply. You can find me at my website, nightbloomcoaching.com. And there's a blog. Feel free to read along. I talk about intimacy and loss pretty regularly. And that is also where you'll see if there are workshops that I'm running. And that is where you can reach out to me to consult for coaching if you ever want to work one-on-one with me, if what I say resonates and you want support.
And I definitely recommend somatic coaching. It's been so helpful. You helped me through a tough spot. So thank you, Kate.
It was my pleasure.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Sabrina.
Thank you so much for listening to our episode today. There's so much to take away here with Kate's wisdom. I want to finish by inviting you again to join us for an in-person TFMR retreat in Tepoztlan, Mexico on April 4th through 7th of this year, 2024. If you like what Kate and I are talking about here and want to experience these healing modalities live, come on retreat with us. There's more info for you at thetfmrdoula.com/tfmr-retreat. That will be in the description. Take care and subscribe to this podcast. Share it with a TFMR bestie or someone who you think would like this episode.